G'day and welcome to another installment of the Fly Fishers podcast.
Since 1967, we've been spreading the bug of fly fishing at our Melbourne fly shop.
Join us as we celebrate the fun of fly fishing and chat with characters that enjoy it as much as we do.
Whether you're just starting out or have some experience, we hope our ego-free commentary helps demystify fly fishing and inspires you to visit new places and try new techniques.
So today's episode is late season river fishing. We're joined by Philip Weigel. Phil, welcome back to the podcast, mate.
Thanks, Andrew.
How's your river season been?
It's been really good. I think the last few years have been exceptionally good. This one's been a little bit different because it's been a season of parts, from fairly high flows early to surprisingly moderate flows later in spring. And then thinking, whoa, might get a bit dry. And then we got all that summer rain and everything boofed back up again.
Yeah.
And then the last part, which has been the last month or so, where things have really got pretty stable and low and clear. And the whole sort of fishing strategy and so forth has had to change to match that. But it happens to be some of my favourite fishing of the year.
Yeah. Do you think this season, as far as the preparation up to that late season, has been pretty typical as far as Australian conditions go, or has it been more on the dry side, would you say, for our northeast rivers?
It's been on the dry side, but just the dry side, not exceptionally dry.
Right.
Yeah. It's if you look at the rainfall at Buller and Hotham and those places which feed or are an indicator of the rainfall for a lot of those northeast catchment, there's been pretty good. But it's been a bit of an unusual sort of pattern in the sense that, as I say, December and January were very wet and then it sort of dried off very late in summer. And then there's been bits and pieces since. You could... If there is such a thing as typical, and by the time you get to my age, you start to wonder if that's even a meaningful word.
Yeah.
Of course, the variability is such a thing with everything, but especially fly fishing.
Yeah.
The you'd normally think, you know, really wet spring. Well, we didn't get that. We got a moderately wet spring, then dry out into sort of late December, January, February, and then, you know, autumn rain coming in moderation, maybe March into April. Well, this year it's not been that pattern.
Yeah.
So it's been a little bit topsy turvy, but it's still been really good. Yeah. I've had some magic fishing, and I've had some magic fishing the last week or so. So it's still going, but you do have to probably think a little bit more about where you go compared to last season.
Okay.
Yeah. When water was just not an issue. It was just water everywhere right through.
Yeah. But this season in particular, there's never really been a bad point in the season, has there?
It seems to
have just powered the whole way
through. It's powered through, but you have had to, in the last few weeks, you've had to rethink how you fish.
Right.
Yeah. That's how I'd describe it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
where you fish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you love autumn fishing.
I do.
Yeah. Why is that?
Because it's so visual and it's probably the best time of the year, all things being equal, to have fish up in the middle of the day, rising and obviously therefore being a target for dry flies. In terms of level of difficulty, it's probably a bit higher because the lower flows, clear water, and... The fact that the fish tend to be sipping like that in the quieter water means the opportunity to sort of get a good presentation is tougher. But compared to, say, throwing a royal wolf and a nymph up into a tumbling run, which is what we've been able to get away with for the vast majority of the last 3 years. So that still happens, but only in places. But the fishing I love is that sipper fishing, as I call it.
Right.
Yeah.
So what is that?
So it's... when the fish are up on the surface pretty consistently from about late morning till sometimes right through till dark, and they're literally just sipping very small insects as a rule off the surface. So they're gentle risers, they're not easy to see, and it's one of those things where you often just have to stop and stare because they're not going flat out, you know. They'll have a little, like just about any hatch you care to name, there are pulses, Maybe it's a little puffs of wind blowing stuff off trees. Maybe it's light, maybe whatever it is. And if you stare and you stare, nothing, 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 and then all of a sudden there's just these little tiny sips. And the size of the sip, as always, is no indication of the size of the fish.
Yeah, yeah. Is it hard to see those sipping
trout? It is, yeah. It is. So you've got to just stop and stare.
Yeah. So is it just they're sort of sucking the fly?
Yeah, they're eating little food. So it seems to be, regardless of what it actually is, it's almost always really small. So sometimes it can be small terrestrial stuff. Sometimes it can be small aquatic insects like mayfly and midge and caddis. But the common theme is it's little and obviously very easy for them to eat. You know, you don't see many slashy risers. You don't see big glomps. You just literally, sippers. They just sip them off the top.
Right.
And
so that extra challenge.
I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's always really rewarding when you catch one. And look, you know, obviously, like, as always, some days they're easier than others. Some fish are easier than others.
Yeah.
But it's mesmerizing, you know. It's pretty much the archetypical fly fishing experience of sighting in broad daylight, sight fishing with dry flies to what are often really good fish.
Yeah.
You know, there's no limitation on what those fish might be. Mm. You know, they could easily be 2, even 3 pounds.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So they're often the better fish. Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably a bit skewed towards the better fish, in fact.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yep. It's time for a short break to talk about the legends who bring this podcast to life. Our committed team at The Fly Fisher prepare, record, and edit in-house in South Melbourne. We put huge effort in for you listeners. We hope that means when it comes time to make a fly fishing purchase, you consider us. With your loyalty, we can keep producing these podcasts and bringing you the world's best fly fishing gear. So shop smart and support the fly shop that supports you. So let's, you know, just dial it back to talking autumn fishing. You know, fairly typical, the water does tend to drop a little bit. You might say it's almost overly settled conditions in gin clear water.
Yep.
How do we deal with that?
You just have to be more careful. So things that you would have got away with 3 months ago, you're probably not going to get away with now.
Yeah.
There's a few things you can do to make a difference. One is, a really basic one, is a long leader.
Right.
Because long leaders don't like to land heavily. So I'm talking here 12, 14 feet, even perhaps a bit more. And also they have a tendency not to lay out straight. And that's a good thing because that gives you a bit of automatic slack so that the fly drifts as naturally as possible.
Right. Okay.
And it's interesting, Andrew, if you watch these sipping fish, sometimes they'll be in a backwater, sometimes they'll be in a bubble line. The currents that they're in will move.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to stop and watch for a minute and just watch how these currents pulse. And I was fishing to a fish with JD the other day, and it was almost like waiting for the perfect wave because if you cast at the wrong moment, the currents were wrong. So even though the fish kept rising, it was almost impossible to get a good drift because of the way from where our position to where the fish was rising was kind of dragging the fly, no matter how carefully you mended and how careful your cast was. But if you waited, and this took minutes to notice, there were like these moments when the current got really even and steady. Right. And so if you landed your fly at that moment, you got the right drift.
Okay.
And after about only 20 tries, eventually fly and 3 pound rainbow are in the same place at the same time.
Yeah. So it was more a timing thing than it was an accuracy thing.
Correct. And that's often the case. And just on that, you know, don't be too quick to blame your fly.
Yep.
Because often you think you've done the perfect cast, but in the time it's taken for your fly to land on the water, that current's just moved over a bit and the fish with it, right? The fish just follow that current.
Yeah,
you know, they're underneath it. They know that if they stay under the bubbles, that's where the food will be.
Okay.
So it's not a genuine refusal. It's just that since your fly landed, the sweet spot has moved.
Right. So because the fish is so high in the water column, does that make their window quite narrow?
It does. And not only that, you know, their focal length would be really short because they're trying to pick up tiny food. So they can't really go broad scan when they're trying to eat little aphids and tiny duns and maybe, you know, flying ants, that sort of stuff. They can't go broad, you know, like they could if they were feeding on hoppers or Kosciuszko duns.
Yeah.
You know, they're just really having to get that mouth-eye coordination thing happening.
Yeah.
So they're just picking them off, you know, and they're really that side, they're just not going to see it. It's not that they're refusing it, they're just not seeing it.
Yeah. Do you think that's is that an observation you've had quite regularly, particularly guiding clients? You think the trout has refused it, but in actual fact, the fish hasn't seen your fly.
That's right. So there's basically three ways in which a fish cannot eat a fly. One is a conscious refusal. One is what I'd call an ignorance, where it doesn't even contemplate your fly as food. And one is just bad timing. You know, you've put your dun out there on a lake and the fish has just happened to see a real one at the same moment and has eaten that one instead.
He's been distracted by it.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's... you know, it's really important with sippers especially to recognise that at the very least the fish has to see the fly and it has to be drifting the same as the real food.
Right.
And that can take a few goes. Fortunately, if you stay low, if you stay back, if you use a long leader and a long tippet and a small, inoffensive, for want of a better word, fly, you do often get quite a few shots.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's the good news.
Yeah.
It's not that you can't stuff them up. Of course you can. You know, if you land the fly line anywhere near them, they're going to be gone.
Yeah. I guess the other good news, which you've kind of indicated there, is the fly pattern doesn't seem to matter too much.
Apart from being
of a small, subtle kind of nature.
Yeah, so if you're looking for a starting point, a little spinner pattern seems to be good. When I say little, I'm talking probably a size 16, maybe 18. A little F fly, one of the most basic flies known to man. It's a remarkably effective fly for these fish. A little ant pattern. Yeah, I think occasionally, yes, they probably are being selective and they're real bastards. Mind you, if you throw something at them long enough, sometimes they'll still eat it, you know. Yeah. But more often than not, they're being a little bit general in what they're eating, but the common thread is that it's little. So you can't cover them with a royal wolf or a great big, you know, shaving brush because it's just not on their agenda.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned aphids there before.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that.
Well, I can't tell you too much except a couple of my mates tell me that that's what some of these absolute bastard fish are eating. At this time of year, they're feeding on the willow leaves and things and falling into the water, and they're tiny, like they're match head size.
Yeah.
So
it looks like they're the kind of thing people mistaken for willow grubs quite often.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah.
So the willow similar kind of green colour. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're little. They're tiny and they're round. You know, they're like a little beetle.
Yep.
Yeah. Tiny little beetle. But, you know, it's be a Pyrrhic victory to realise that they're on aphids because you wouldn't have a fly in your box small enough to imitate an aphid.
Yeah.
So my approach, and maybe, you know, there may well be anglers out there with a better approach than me, but my approach is just still to persist with those little F flies, little spinners, things that I think the fish will be seeing often enough that maybe if I drift it over the fish enough times, it will eat.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, my one experience with an aphid feeder, I found a fluorescent green caddis pupa pattern in my box that I was able to gink up and get to sit just in the film.
Yep.
And that was deadly effective.
Fantastic. Well, there you
but
go.
But the aphids we came across that day were actually quite large. I reckon they were almost probably 8 to 10 mil long.
Oh, well, that's good.
Yeah.
But, you know, that may still work. Sometimes, who knows what goes through their tiny brains. I mean, sometimes maybe colour is enough, even if the size is wrong.
Yeah,
you know?
Maybe. Especially in the fluorescent sort of colours.
But a really important point on colour, you've got to be able to see your fly.
Yeah.
Because often these fish rise quite regularly, and if you can't see your fly, you can't be sure it was or wasn't your fly being eaten.
Right.
And a little olive F fly that I was using most recently, it is remarkably visible for a tiny fly. And I definitely reckon the last time I used it, I caught several of my fish primarily because I could see the fly. Not only could I track how well it was drifting, so I knew when I wasn't right, I actually knew rise, that was me, you know. And I would have struck on the first or second rise if I hadn't had a fly I could see, thinking that would have been me, just judging on where I expected the fly to be without being able to see it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Often overlooked with flies, isn't it? But that being able to see it,
yep.
That's what makes it an effective fly.
Correct. Exactly. And sometimes it's more important than other times. Like the fish is rising every 30 seconds and there's a rise where you think your fly was. Well, it probably was you. But if they're rising, you know, six times in a row, bang, 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 and you can't see your fly, you're really just having to toss a coin.
Mm.
And probably unsuccessfully.
Yeah. Mm. Now, you're big on fishing as heavy tippet as you can get away with.
Yes, I am.
So what tippet diameter are you fishing with a size 16?
Look, I'm trying to get away with 4X. There was one fish I was fishing too recently, and I thought, if I hook this, if I'm on 5X, I'm not going to be able to keep it out of the logs, right? So I thought I'd rather not hook it than hook it and bust off.
Yeah.
So I thought, damn it, I'll try the 4X, even though it was probably a little heavy for this sort of size 16, maybe even 18 little F-fly I was using, but the fish did eat it. So, you know, it was good. And and my mate said, thank God you're on the 4X.
Yeah.
Because this fish was absolutely crazy and it just was doing its darndest to burrow into the logs.
Yeah.
And I was just giving it to it and I still thought it was going to break the line, but somehow I didn't.
Cooler water temperatures, do the fish fight that bit harder, do you think, at this time of year?
Look, yeah, possibly, but I think they just look in that sort of situation. They're going to like on a really warm in really warm water that we might have had in the middle of summer. Yes, they wouldn't fight as hard, but yeah, probably ever since, you know, March, the water's been cool enough for them to fight hard, and it's probably just the circumstances.
Right.
I remember that Peter Morse once told me, and I thought this was very interesting. We were talking about permit. I was very proud of having caught a permit. We sort of sound like we're sidetracking, but we're not. And I said, man, they fight hard, don't they, Peter? And he said, oh, they do. But he said, I think they seem to fight a lot harder than they actually do because people are so terrified of losing them. And I thought that was a great point, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, if you really care whether you're going to land it or not, it probably makes the fish appear to fight a lot harder. It's probably a lot more stressful.
Sure.
And I think, when you're hooking a fish in close contact to logs and twigs and, you know, things that you might get broken off on, it probably seems to fight a lot more powerfully than it really does. So much that can go wrong. But on top of that too, you know, they're in really good condition because they've had such a good year. So, yeah, that part probably is real.
Mm.
You know, this big rainbow that I keep talking about, it was a football. Mm. You know, it looked like it came out of a lake.
Mm. And on the Goulburn, was it?
Yeah, on the Goulburn, one, yeah. 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 And I got a couple in the Jamison and the upper Goulburn that were perhaps not quite as fat, but still really, really thick set, you know, for a natural river fish.
Yeah, good.
And they just fight hard, yeah. So they've had a good year by and large, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You touched on it a little bit, but where would the trout sit in the rivers at this time of year?
I guess they're looking... So one of the things that I suspect about cold water is that it's weird, you know. Sometimes they'll actually not be in those really fast runs that we expect them to be in. And it's almost like they're too lazy in that colder water, less energetic, or maybe that's a food thing. Maybe they can see the food more easily in the quieter water. Water that I'd walk straight past for a lot of the year, like those slow, it's got to be flowing because they're still drift feeding. They still need a current to be bringing food towards them. But that sort of slow to medium pace runs and pulls with a distinct bubble line coming down so that you've got a focal point to stare at to see if you can see a fish, and also backwaters. They love the backwaters.
Is that because the food's there? Or just...
Yeah, I think it's where they can easily get the food without much work. So it's low energy feeding this, you know. The energy profit would be high because they're not fighting very much current at all. Not that they're not good at fighting current anyway, but in that slow water, they can just, you know, they've really got the little sort of sushi train coming down and they just, you know,
yeah,
nip, nip, nip. and barely expend a kilojoule doing so.
What about cover and shelter? Are they quite
They would rather have it, but they will do without it if the food reward's there.
Right.
Yeah, it's surprising fish that you wouldn't see for a lot of the year, for whatever reason, seem prepared to be a little bit more bold, which is some sort of offset towards that clear, you know, painfully low, still water that they will move out. Yeah, a good fish that I got in the Jamison lately, I really didn't think I'd catch it because I thought, you know what, I'm just going to line this fish.
Mm.
It was in such an exposed spot. It granted a bit of shade, but it was still out in the middle, meter of water, gentle current. Mm. I thought, I'm just not going to be able to land the fly without spooking this fish. But hey, he ate it. So that was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that happened with a few others. Can I say, over the course of the last few weeks, there's been plenty that haven't eaten it as well, right? So, yeah sometimes they are just about impossible, or at least impossible to me.
And that's part of the appeal of fishing.
It is. But when you get one, it's bloody great. Oh, yeah. It really is very, very cool.
Yeah.
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 Good. Now, I feel like we went down a bit of a rabbit hole talking about sippers and dry fly fishing.
Yes.
Maybe tell us a bit more about the nymph fishing and what we can expect.
Definitely worth doing. So I think as always, or not as always, that's a sweeping generalisation, but I think finding those nice little holding drop-offs, bits of structure in the fast water, and really just working a nymph through down deep is well worth doing, but it has to be down deep. Usually, often it does. This time of year, it really does. Like if you're a foot off the bottom, you're not going to succeed.
Right.
So I still enjoy fishing an indicator rather than Euro nymphing, but it's probably Euro nymphing paradise.
Sure.
And just look for the little lips and drops and, you know, bits of water where the fish got a little bit more cover in that fast water, and man, there's some good fish in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't have to be deep, but just try to pick out the spots that are just that little bit different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And especially so on the Goulburn, would you say?
Oh, yes, especially so on the Goulburn, but anywhere.
Right.
Any river.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's got some faster water in between the slow bits. You know, if there was ever an argument for two rods, or at least a mate fishing one way and you fishing another, this would be it, because it's a totally different setup for the sipper fishing than for the nymph fishing. So,
and the nymph patterns, what's an observation with those?
Small and heavy,
yep.
I think.
Yep.
I don't think big and heavy is working very well for me.
Yeah.
But small and heavy is. And then there's the issue of how obvious do you want your fly to be? You know, pulling power versus eating power. The perennial dilemma. I think I probably feel like you can be reasonably natural and get away with it. So a good fly for me lately has been a little catter scrub, just a plain, it's on ineffective flies. I think, what does Craig call it? The Tyena caddis, perhaps?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, just a basic, really basic catter scrub.
Yep.
And that might be confidence as much as anything. And maybe a pheasant tail.
Yeah,
with a little bit of a hot dot on it, just something to catch their attention.
Yeah.
Do
you think the bead colour matters much?
That's a very good question. I don't honestly know. I've grappled with bead colour forever.
Yeah.
And it's just so hard to nail. Like the comp fishers have these theories about silver in one kind of water and gold in another kind of water and bronze in another kind of water. I honestly don't know.
Mm.
Yeah.
So it sounds like dry flies and nymphs maybe downsizing the fly.
Yeah, I think
fishing a little.
Yeah,
bit.
I think so. I think it's really important, like I say, that nymph gets down. I mean, the water's clear everywhere, so in theory, at least, the fish shouldn't have any trouble finding the fly.
Yeah.
So in October or November, you may want a big, fairly bright nymph, just so that the fish can find it in that slightly discoloured water. Now that's not an issue anymore.
Mm.
Or not right at the moment anyway, and for the next week or so by the looks of it.
That makes sense, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think something that they're prepared to eat that can get down is the key with the nymph.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And places to go, small streams or tail races?
Obviously the Goulburn's been good forever. we're really reaping the benefits of those higher winter flows, which a lot of anglers probably weren't even aware of, but it's there on Flystream that a few years ago a case was made to keep the minimum flow of the Goulburn over winter a bit higher. And as is often observed world over, the carrying capacity of a river is really determined by
its lowest water point.
When it's at its worst, right? Not at its best.
Yeah.
So if you go to a New Zealand river in spring and think, gosh, there doesn't seem to be many fish in here, well, if you saw it in February, you'd understand why. Right. Now, fish will move in and out of rivers, sure, but at the end of the day, the carrying capacity, including the food supply, is determined by what the low flow state of that stream is. So having a low flow of 400 megalitres a day versus the old 160 megalitres a day, I think has been a real boon for that river.
Yeah.
And... you know, the fish population and the quality of the fish is very, very good. I mean, we're really lucky to have it.
Yeah.
It can be a frustratingly technical river for me as well. And it can be a river where, you know, you think, where the bloody hell are they? But they're there, you know. And that's a really encouraging thing. So yes, the Goulburn itself and the rivers that are probably closer to the southern ends of the catchments, because those parts have had like the big river, Marysville Big River, not the Anglers Rest Big River, Rubicon, any of those rivers on that sort of southern side of the Eildon catchment, and probably as you work your way north, they're getting skinnier and skinnier because they haven't quite caught that rain that's come up from the south in the last little while.
Yeah.
And, of course, the Mitter tailwater. Mm-hmm. The upper Mitter too would be well worth a go, although as every day goes by at this time of year, it's getting progressively colder and colder up there. And to me, the sort of fishing that I really enjoy will eventually be killed by the cold on all the rivers. So if you can find some that are not as elevated, as shaded, you'll get a longer tail end of the season.
Obviously the fishing you enjoy is more what we're describing here, but there is that point where the fish switch over to spawning mode. Some of these smaller streams, is it true that some of the better fish move into the smaller streams quite a bit before it actually comes time to spawn?
They can do. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And similarly, you know, you'll find, I guess, for whatever reason, as it gets, maybe it's a stocking up for winter sort of thing, but you'll find bigger fish out in daylight in more obvious spots in many rivers as a function of the late autumn fishing. So whether that's a pre-spawn thing, whether it's a feed up for winter thing, and you will, yes, some fish will begin to move up the small streams. How much water's in those streams is probably a big factor in that.
Right.
And how sort of keen they are to feed. So, yeah, at the moment, yeah, there'll be good fish present in any water that can hold them.
Trout move around a lot.
They do. And as a species, within one sort of cohort, there'll be the migrators and the stay at homes.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Which is a real sort of evolutionary survival thing, right?
Yeah.
So you want some of the cohort to go out into the big wide world and make a home for themselves elsewhere, because if a catastrophe hits home water, all the eggs aren't in one basket, so to speak.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it makes sense for some of the fish to be stay at home. So studies show that some fish, some trout, will spawn in the run at the head of their home pool. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're not going anywhere. They're just
and others will swim out to sea and go 200 kilometres along the coastline and swim up another river.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's absolutely extraordinary how variable they are. And it's probably stood them in good stead over the years, because
well adapted.
It just spreads the risk.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
By not having them all stay at home. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. So, you know, when autumn rolls around, what rivers are you kind of, what's on your radar typically?
Look, always the tailwaters, right?
Yeah.
Assuming the flows are at a good level, which they pretty much are at the moment. So the Kiwi, the Mitter,
Swampy.
The Swampy, the Murray proper especially, right. You know, definitely the Murray proper.
Yep.
Much better access and almost as good a fishing. Some of the best super fishing I've ever had has been on the Murray at Tawong and Bringambrong and those sort of places, you know. Yep. Classic. So assuming Snowy Hydro don't get too carried away with how much water they're chucking down, because this whole sipper thing is killed by high flows.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Not that you can't catch fish, but the sipper thing is a function of gentle flows. So if the Goulburn were at, you know, 5,000 megalitres a day instead of the current sort of 2,500 megalitres a day, it'd be a whole different story. Yes, you could probably find them, but the places you'd find them would be limited, because A good way of thinking of it is if you go to a really big pool and it's what I would call creased, so you can see the sort of, you know, the water doing little swirly things.
Yep.
I think, I don't think this is going to work.
Yeah.
You know, I want that nice flat sort of surface.
Yeah.
As an indicator of the flow being about right.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think that's what you're looking for, and you're often going to get it at the moment.
Yeah.
On those tailwaters, the Kiwa, the Midder, the Goulburn, of course, and up on the border, the Upper Murray especially, because it's got more of that sort of languid sort of water than the Swampy. Now, I mean, you'll catch them in the Swampy.
Yeah.
But you know, you can your access and everything is so much better down on the Murray proper.
Okay.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess the small streams, though, if you were to fish the small streams over the tail races at this time of year, any rivers that really stand out or any techniques you think in the smaller water that might be worthwhile knowing?
I guess the same sort of thing is whilst the flows are low, just stay back and look, don't get the sippers in. Yeah, or even just fish on nymphs and dries, but just don't blunder onto them.
Right.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is I've come across this all my life is anglers believe, because they're not seeing fish, that the fish aren't there, as if they've got these amazing sort of infrared eyes, you know.
they may have Smith Optics low light.
Yeah, that's right.
it's not X-ray vision, and
you know, it I'm still amazed by how I can be fishing a river that's very, very low and very, very painfully clear in the middle of the day and thinking I can see everything.
Mm.
You know, even spooking fish, and then there's nothing here, and then go back there on a mild evening when there's a hatch and suddenly there's fish, half a dozen fish rising in that same bit of water where you couldn't see one to save yourself.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think the lesson in that is, you know, you've really got to stare bloody hard and fish from well back before you sort of blunder onto a bit of water and then think, oh, yeah, there's nothing there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And do you find the rainbows and the browns in different sorts of water, or are they?
The sippers, they tend to be basically the same at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm struggling to differentiate. Like the usual rule when it's really, when the flows are really big, the rainbows are more inclined to be in that very, very fast water, although it's still only a loose rule. It's not a hard and fast rule.
Yeah.
And look, I should jump in and say the evening rises are hanging in there.
Yeah.
Yep. Now, for how much longer, I don't know, but it is worth trying to be on the water on dark at the moment. Whilst we have this somewhat milder weather, you could get 15 minutes of Kosciuszko Duns right on dark.
Yeah.
And that's very good fun.
Probably the best part of the day. And a nice way to finish it.
Well, it's certainly nice to put on a size 10 fly or a size 12 fly and, you know,
3X sippet.
Some 3X, if not 2X. and have a nice blast away in that fast water for those fish slashing, you know, instead of sipping.
Yeah.
But that's probably a day-to-day proposition. But if it were me, I'd still be hanging around waiting for that on natural streams and on the tailwaters.
Okay.
Yeah. For those last minute dun / caddis hatches.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Won't be home for dinner.
Won't be home for dinner. Yeah. It's not dark until you can see stars in the sky, Mum.
Yeah. Good. The browns, they spawn first. Rainbows.
Yeah, they do. There's considerable overlap.
Yep.
But yes. As a rule, the Browns spawn sooner. But once again, risk spreading, environmental factors like rain and cold and flow will have an impact on when they spawn, right?
Okay.
So, you know, once you've got fish that are Browns especially, once they're genuinely spawning, it's lockjaw. You know, they're almost going to self-preserve by their reluctance to eat a fly. Mm. So sort of be careful what you wish for there. But pre-spawning, different story.
Yeah.
Almost the opposite. You know, compensating for that period when they're going to be eating very little and they're totally focused on making babies.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Do you ever fish the spawn run?
No.
No. Have you ever?
As a young guy, I did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But for me personally, if it's legal and you obey the rules, you know, I've got no problem with it. But for me, I kind of just lost interest in it.
Yeah.
And I especially lost interest in some of the bad behaviour I saw in New South Wales, especially on the spawn run rivers.
Yeah.
Just lack of courtesy and you know, I hear people say, how was it up there on the Yukonbeen River? Oh, it was terrible. He said, I was sitting on a pool waiting for a fish to move and this guy walked straight past me and threw his lure through it.
Yeah.
Sometimes even a fly. Yeah. And I'm thinking, well, you know, that's the deal. If you're not prepared to cop that, don't do that kind of fishing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because really that as they'd call it in the US, combat fishing, is not, you know, isn't for everybody.
If you're prepared to
put up with that sort of invasion of personal space, bad behavior, ignorant behavior, because let's face it, some people will just be doing the wrong thing because they don't know any better.
Yeah. So is it worth pointing out that catching trout at that point in time is you're getting them at their most vulnerable state throughout the year?
Well, I guess what you are getting in that situation, and again, like the Yukonbeen and the Thredbo Rivers are examples on steroids, because you've got very, very productive lakes fed by comparatively small rivers. So there's a super concentration of super big fish, which is why, you know, they're so famous.
Mm.
The Tongariro does the same sort of thing in New Zealand.
Mm. Almost year-round over there.
Almost year-round, yeah. Yeah, if you get enough fish, the spawning season can be very, very long.
Mm.
So it's not by virtue of how voracious they are that they're vulnerable. It's more by virtue of the sheer number of fish that are way bigger than most people encounter on a stream in a typical year. Yeah. So we don't have that so much in Victoria, but that's not to say you wouldn't find some pretty big spawners out in the open where you wouldn't normally expect to see those sort of fish.
Sure.
But I like finding them when they're sipping.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because then they're actually, you know, for want of a better word, an aesthetically pleasing target.
they're feeding fish that you have to convince to eat your fly.
Yes, but they're still often bigger than what you would see 2 months ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think there is something going on there with maybe the lower light in the sky, Andrew.
Yeah.
Maybe that sense of urgency, the water's getting colder, winter's coming. Now's my chance to put on a bit of food before I, you know, go off and spawn. Whatever it is, I don't honestly know.
Yeah.
But
they're active.
You see a lot more big fish more often on all the streams, not just the tailwaters. Mm. And they're do the right thing with your technique and they're catchable.
Yeah.
You know? So you can kind of have the best of both worlds.
I don't think this is something you do a lot of, but big streamers, do they work quite well in autumn?
Oh, they no doubt would.
Yeah.
It's a good idea. It's a good idea. And I don't get me wrong, I have no problem with it, right? Mm. And at certain times I'll fish a big streamer.
Yeah.
And not just in autumn. Like I'll fish it at other times because it can sometimes save your day.
Yeah.
And I don't really always understand why. It makes a lot more sense in autumn when they're getting aggressive and probably more territorial and probably feeling a little bit safer with the lower light, even though it may not seem like lower light to us. It has to be because, you know, you're not going to get sunburned in April the same as you do in January.
Yeah.
There are definitely opportunities for that. One thing I think about streamer fishing is you kind of, it's do or die. Like once you've dragged that big wet through a pool a few times and haven't caught something, that's probably that gone.
Yeah.
Yeah, but with the sippers, you can literally have hours of fishing on one decent bit of water.
I wonder if that's why the guys that are fishing those big streamers are typically drifting.
Yeah, and probably and moving around a lot. And yeah. Look, don't get me wrong. Like I say, it's a really legitimate way to fish. And if you're
and
catching
it's fun
good,
and it, visual too.
Yeah, visual,
especially out of the boat.
Yeah, yeah. In a drift boat, it'd be great. And you can do it on foot. A couple of my mates do it a lot more than me, and they do well. You know, and that'll and like I say, I can think of a couple of occasions over the last few years, not necessarily this time of year, where incredibly dead fishing has been turned around by me walking back down the river. Pulling a big magoo.
Yeah.
It's just bizarre. It, again, proof that because you can't see the fish doesn't mean they're not there. You know, I'm sort of thinking, where have all the fish gone? Yeah. You know, and then I get the streamer out and sort of fish my way back just out of curiosity and catch three or four fish. So, yeah, it's a good option. But for whatever reason, you know, I'm just addicted to that little dry fly stuff.
Oh,
you know?
fair enough.
Yeah, and it's really nice getting them on the nymph too. Don't get me wrong, but that's my – if my mates say, look, who wants to do the sippers, who wants to fish the nymph, I'll fish to the sippers because I just – it's just a – it only lasts for a few weeks, maybe a month.
Yeah.
At its very best. Yeah. And, yeah, I want to make the most of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've kind of done the wrong thing. I guess we're you know, recording this podcast. What is it? The 2nd of May, 3rd of May, whatever it is. So we're kind of getting towards the end of it now.
We are. It's going to hang in there while this big high is over us though.
Right.
Yeah. So look, don't start too early. Got to give it time to warm up. You're just going to be going when you should be coming if you start too early.
Yeah.
That little, you need that fog to go. Fog's the enemy. You just don't want that. So the fog might take until nearly midday to burn away. But whilst this settled weather's with us, they should keep going. Touch wood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So starting a little bit late, you think that warmth, that sun hitting the water, the brighter days? Or
Bright's fine. Doesn't need to be cloudy. Cloudy's fine too.
Yep.
The main, you just don't want much wind. Wind doesn't seem to be good because it just messes up that surface. I mean, you can still find little corners and things where it's still doable, but I would rather not have too much wind. So settled is the sort of, in every respect, the flows, the weather, settled is what you want. But being May, you need to give it time to warm up.
So have you got your finger on the pulse with current flow rates for these tail races before you
do definitely. Definitely. I'd always look.
And what are you looking at in flows?
Oh, look, I would probably rather 3,500 or less on the Goulburn.
Yep.
And really there's no bottom limit, but of course as it gets really low, as it drops down towards that 400, some water's just going to be too still. On the really big pools, it's just going to be too flowless.
Yeah.
Some of that stuff up towards Snobs Creek, you know, where you've just got those super big, long, still pools. It's not that there won't be fish rising, but they'll be very, very difficult to track because they won't be drift feeding. They'll be just wandering.
Yeah. And stability in flow, is that a...
That's good, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
So if you've seen a spike or a drop in flow or it's happening the day that you're there...
Yeah, I'd rather it wasn't coming up. I wouldn't mind if it was dropping a bit, but I'd rather it wasn't coming up. If it was coming up, that might be better for nymphing.
Yep.
But not so good for the sippers.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would have almost thought it to be the opposite, you know, like dropping water I would have thought might be something that makes a fish go a bit weird, but I don't know why I'm thinking that.
Oh, it's a legitimate thought, and it's as I keep saying, the longer I do this, the less of a reliable witness I am for any rules, right? Because you just keep seeing the rules get broken. But yeah, a gentle drop for sippers is within reason is good. Yeah, if it drops from low to super low, maybe not. But if it's just dropping from moderate to a bit lower, yeah, great. Yeah,
good.
Yeah, just more of that smooth water we're looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah, rather than the creased, messy stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ah, that's good. Anything else you'd like to add as far as technique or things that people need to keep an eye out for during autumn fishing?
I just think, you know, just – tread quietly, move slowly.
Stealth.
Look.
Yeah.
Don't just blast your way up, or you'll be, you know, spooking fish without knowing you've even done it.
And keeping a low profile.
Keeping a low profile. The usual stuff about dive clothes. But, you know, crossing, just be careful of your bow waves, you know, because they're going to go further up the pool than they would have a few months ago.
Good point.
And that's never a good thing. I mean, again, you know, sometimes fish will tolerate that, sometimes they won't. But you might as well put as many odds in your favour as you can.
Mm.
So, yeah, move slowly, carefully. Keep the wading. Don't wade if you don't have to. And if you do wade, just wade really slowly. Don't lift your feet too much, you know.
Mm.
Don't sort of walk like you normally would. Lift your feet a little, but slide them rather than sort of clomp, clomp, clomp.
Yeah.
And if you do put a bit of a wave up the river and it's unavoidable, just stop for a minute. Just let it subside and then wade again. And, yeah, and I can't stress looking hard.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to see these fish if you don't look hard. And, Andrew, there'll be places where they should be and they're not, and there'll be places where you think, oh, I don't think there'll be one here, but I have a quick look and damn, there's two, you know, two beauties going for it. So it's not a neat formula, but yeah, look hard in all the possible places where that food might be a bit concentrated, but it's flat enough that the fish are going to be able to have a leisurely feed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing I find fishing in autumn as well, which always catches me out, is the middle of the day is it's hot. Like when you're fishing, quite often you get warm.
The solar radiation can heat you up surprisingly if there's no wind and no shade. Yeah.
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 But then, you know, come when the sun starts to drop, the temperature just plummets, dressing accordingly.
It's not easy. It's not
the layering really comes into its own during that time of year.
Yeah.
You know, I think it has to be said too, just the beauty of these areas.
Oh, it's pretty.
Isn't it?
The autumn colours are just that. I was driving through, where was I the other day when we were out? It was on the Upper Goulburn, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And the colours, I was just thinking, if I took a photo of this, people would think I'd photoshopped it.
Yeah.
Because there's all these, even for a colourblind bloke like me, there's still oranges and reds and yellows. And it's just, you're thinking, how did nature come up with this idea?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. What was the value? I mean, other than making us love it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's, I know you've always got that, I'm looking forward to something, because the season always has so much to offer.
It does.
But is it a little bit depressing in a way that the rivers are drawing to a close? Do you find that hard?
I do. I find it less hard than I used to because I've got so much to look forward to over winter now.
Mm.
So, you know, I'm really almost starting to bust for an estuary fish, which I haven't done for a few months. Going to do some Sydney salt water in about a month.
Fantastic.
And, you know, the lake fishing. That lake fishing just keeps going.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the Crater Lakes and those sort of lakes, you know, it's almost at their best coming into winter. So it's good not to have to make, like, at the moment you have to make that hard decision. Like, I'm thinking about going fishing next week and I really, really hand on heart don't know whether to go to a river, go to a lake or go to an estuary, right? So I'm almost going to have to spin a wheel or something to make the decision.
Sport for
Whereas choice. Once the river's in 2 weeks or so, depending upon what the weather does, you know, the rivers will become a pretty, for me, tenuous option. It's not to say you can't fish right up till the close, of course you can. But when the trees are bare and it's foggy until sort of 1 o'clock in the afternoon and it's cold, you know, I don't know. It's just like, it's a bit meh.
Yeah.
It's not that you can't catch a fish. It's just for me, the joy of it has dropped below whatever that threshold is. And, when you've got, you know, the estuary fishing as good as it ever is, and the lake fishing in certain cases being as good as it ever is, the rivers lose, you know.
Yeah.
So before the genuine close of the season on the rivers, I'm sort of already, I've said my goodbyes and see you in September.
Yeah. We are lucky to have so much good fishing, aren't we?
Oh, we are.
Yeah.
We are. Yeah.
Phil, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate. Thank you for revealing all the secrets around autumn fly fishing. Look, really appreciate it, mate.
No, my great pleasure.
Yeah. Look forward to getting you back on the airwaves very soon.
Very good, mate.
Cheers.
Thanks, Andrew.